This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on location today at the Sotto Voce Poetry Festival in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. We are here with poet Andrea Hollander Buddy, and she's flown in from Arkansas, and she's going to read you a poem.
Sunday Dinner. Always, my grandparents arrived disguised as harmless elders. They'd say grace, bless the three of us and our small residence above my father's office. Residence. I don't choose the word for the poem's sake, but because it was their word, I want you to hear what I heard through all those years before my mother's death, all those Sunday briskets and pot roasts, all those potatoes she and I peeled on Saturdays, and the pies whose crusts we dispatched, till it became ritual, the way I thought the making of the host must be ritual for those who toil in some secret bakery blessed by a bishop. I haven't forgotten, I wrote, disguised. And I know you might wonder if I should have changed that word before I called this poem finished. I meant they had harmed someone, not me, who believed in the prayers they uttered, but my mother, who inhabits me each time I roll out the dough as she did, shape it, fit it to the pan, fill it with mincemeat or apples, pinch the edges together with my thumb and forefinger, and with the tines of my fork, prick it, and prick it, and prick it.
That is the voice of Andrea Hollander Buddy. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, but we're not at the Library of Congress. We're there just in spirit because we're at Shepherdstown, West Virginia, at a festival. Andrea was born in Berlin of American parents, and she was raised in Colorado, Texas, New York, and New Jersey, educated at Boston University and the University of Colorado, and now lives in Arkansas. Today she's ours. She has a voice you can have faith in, and I want to hear that voice again. What is the title of this book?
The book is my recent book. It's called Woman in the Painting.
And who put that out?
It was published in 2006 by Autumn House Press in Pittsburgh.
Also, didn't you have an anthology come out through that press?
That's coming out this November 2008.
I heard you say a line in that poem which is indicative of your style. When a poem is finished... When is a poem finished?
When it speaks in its own voice rather than in my voice. Mm. I guess that's my guide. I draft a poem and then I work on it, but I have to leave it and keep coming back to it because I want it to be a stranger enough so that I don't fall in love with my own words and hold on to them just because they're mine.
Well, they're ours today, so let's hear it. We're the Sotto Voce.
Well, this next poem follows the one I just read because I'm sure that listeners will be interested in knowing what it was that my mother resented about my grandparents. And this will tell some of that story. The poem is called 1938. I remember the way my mother answered when people asked where she'd gone to school. Southside High, 1938, adding the year in the same breath. Though I knew she never graduated, yanked out when her father lost his job. Now it was her turn to make herself useful, he told her. Hadn't he put food on the table all her life and all her little sisters? How necessary to tell a lie like hers, to answer Southside High, 1938, and smile without betraying the blaze in her chest. Her envy for the questioner who likely met her own husband at some university. But wasn't my mother the lucky one, my grandfather was fond of telling her even into my childhood, sometimes in front of my friends, lucky to have got my father, a college man who sat beside her at a ball game in 1939. Just look at her, who didn't finish high school. Didn't I tell her then it wouldn't matter? But of course, it did matter.
Andrea Buddy, she is the author of three full-length poetry collections, Woman in the Painting, The Other Life, and House Without a Dreamer, which won the Nicholas Roerich Poetry Prize. Where does that come out of?
Well, that's sponsored by the Nicholas Roerich Museum in New York City.
And other honors and awards, the D.H. Lawrence Fellowship, a Pushcart Prize, and the Runes Poetry Award. Then two NEA fellowships. Mm-hmm. That is almost not fair. It's just so competitive. I mean, they get 20,000 or 30,000, and you won twice?
I won twice, once in 1991 and once this past year in 2007.
So you're what we would call a practicing professional poet, and this is what you do for a living.
Well, if you could win $20,000 a year, you would do it for a living. I think I'd do it for my life. But as far as making a living is concerned, I'm the writer in residence at a small college in the Arkansas Ozarks, and that allows me to teach what I love to people who are interested in it. And then I do go to festivals like the one we're speaking at right now, and I'm paid to do that. But I write for my heart and for the fact that I can't help it.
That's Andrea Buddy you're listening to. What does a writer in residence actually do?
Well, I teach the creative writing classes. I also teach all of the literature classes in poetry, and I guide any creative writing activities that happen at our school. We give a literary prize once a year, and I chair that committee, situations like that.
Is it a one-time-only deal?
I've done it for 18 years. I'm the writer in residence, and it's a permanent position as long as they still want me and as long as it works out.
And you are thriving, so I think it's going to work out. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on location in beautiful downtown Shepherdstown, West Virginia, at a poetry festival. And Andrea flew in from Arkansas, and she's ours. Let's have some more poetry.
Okay. Well, also from the most recent book, I thought I would read a poem about another poem about my mother, the last one I'll share about my mother, something that happened a lot later in her life and mine. The poem is called Beauty Parlor. One of the regulars had cancer in those days before chemo, and even after the beautician lowered the hairdryer canister over the woman's head, she talked nonstop about the intense heat of cobalt treatments, the way her body burned in places she'd rather not name, how her skin there felt more like leather. When she paused, the beauty parlor grew strangely quiet, only the hum of the dryers, the occasional whoosh of water at the sinks. Until she spoke again, no one looked at her. Then she droned on, but this time about her son, who'd stopped coming by now his wife had him wound around her little finger. I didn't understand yet. It wasn't his wife that kept the son away. I was 17 and only a guest in this world where my mother was a regular on Wednesdays. That day, she sat up front among the women's magazines. After I was done, we'd go to lunch. And in a few days, she'd tell me her own bad news. She'd say she didn't want to spoil my senior prom. But that afternoon, as the woman carried on and on and on, my mother already knew what she knew.
You are known for extolling form and having a high opinion of writing in form. If form is the way we hold our art, how do you describe the way you hold yours?
Well, one of the things I have learned over the years is that deep experience needs to have some distance before it can be transformed. And that transformation is much more easily handled if one is familiar with form, whether it's traditional forms or whether it is form that based on a foundation of learning how to wield the tools that are offered by form. Sometimes a poem will find its own form. But I find that the experience of an actual life, which are the important experiences after all, are best handled with the distance that sometimes come from playing with the language, playing with form, and having that to shape what can become experience, become artistic experience.
What is form?
Well, what form is, well, it's the tools that we use to shape experience, and whether we're talking about visual art or musical art or the oral presentation of literature, it is the vessel that allows the art to exist and be transferred from one receiver to another.
Good answer, Andrea. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Sotto Voce. Give us a poem and talk a little bit, set it up in terms of form for us.
Okay. I think what I will do is read you a very recent poem, in fact, hot off the presses, as they say. I've probably wrote this poem this week, so this is the first time I've been reading, will be reading it aloud. And it's a form called the sonnet. But it's a sonnet that answers the sonnet of another writer, a writer who relatively recently passed away, a poet named William Meredith, who wrote beautiful poems. And sometimes in a way of having a conversation with the past and a way of honoring someone whose work I really like, I find a way of responding to someone else's poem in this way. So in terms of a sonnet form, one of the things I did years ago, well, not that many years ago, is I was living in England for 4 months in an old house, 500 years old, in a little farm village, and every morning I worked on a new sonnet. I thought, I'm in Shakespeare's country, I want to try this. It looks like an easy form, but it's not an easy form. There are 14 lines, as most people know. There has to be a certain meter. There has to be a certain turning of the subject matter at a certain point. And in order to make a sonnet not sound like a sing-song Mother Goose predictable poem, predictable form, you start losing, when you get too involved in the music, you start losing the sensibility and the sense. So I worked on a sonnet a day, during that whole time, I only came up with one sonnet that was good enough to call worthy of sharing with anyone else, but I learned something about the importance of allowing or teaching oneself to let the form start to take over in a more subtle way. Okay, so here's the poem. It's called The Inconsolable. Touching his forehead, she was like the beam of moonlight that wove itself through the lace curtains, multiplying on his calm face that night, making of it something that seemed holy, or would have if she were someone who believed. And for that moment, she did believe. The myriad crescents had come to anoint him who she knew had just died in that otherwise dark, unnatural place where in daylight hours she would visit him and take over for the nurses, feed him, even change his soiled clothes. In this place now, the dark interrupted by these moons, what would you call how she feels touching them?
William Meredith would absolutely love that. That tone, the silkiness of it, there's just not a lump in that sonnet. That's a woman who wrote a sonnet a day. That's how you get to this one. Tell us the process. Pick another poem and say, this is where I was when I got this idea.
Okay. I'll read the opening poem of my recent book, Woman in the Painting. The poem is called Still Life with Jonquils. And what I was thinking about and before I entered the empty notebook, because I always write by hand in an empty notebook, I was thinking about the way that art brings you in, draws you in, but it stops at a certain spot and allows you to continue going. And that's the kind of art I like, whether it's music where you are anticipating and feeling with what the composer has given you as a gift, or whether you're standing in front of a painting or reading a poem, that there is a certain stopping place. And I was thinking about that idea, and I remembered a painting I'd seen. I wasn't standing in front of it, but I begin the poem describing the painting, and then I let the poem take me to the place where I hoped it would go, and in fact, it surprised me and went even deeper than I thought. So I'll share that poem. It's called Still Life with Jonquils, as I said. The usual bowl of fruit, yes. And at attention in a blue porcelain vase, wands of jonquils not yet bloomed, gray-green buds like translucent cocoons, their wet and yellow wings stirring against the thinning threads of gray, about to give way, the way a woman whose wrist has been lightly touched beneath the starched tablecloth recognizes a man's invitation, its promise, as the chatter of dinner guests blurs into nonsense, and she begins to feel the invisible tug on the knot, fixed at the body's center, waiting to be undone. The painter knows what not to execute, knows we bring our own heat to the canvas, knowing exactly how these jonquils would look if open, but not letting them.
I am very interested in your entry into the poems, and tell us how you arrived at that opening line, not your usual, or what was that opening line, your usual painting?
The usual bowl of fruit, yes.
The usual bowl of fruit. So how did you know to start with such a stark declarative sentence?
Oh, that's a mystery. I have to say that if I had the secret at my vocal fingertips, if as it were, I would make a lot of money because I could sell it. There is some mystery about it, even to all of us who write. We don't know why a line begins sometimes where it begins, but I know that I remember sitting in my chair that I always write in, and I remember thinking about what is a still life and what is it about a still life that attracts visual artists. My son is a painter, so I think about visual art quite a lot. And I'm thinking, okay, I've seen my son set up a still life and he's got to balance everything in a certain way. But then there are things that don't end up in the painting. And why not? And so I'm thinking, why not? Why would a painter choose a painting where the buds are all we see and not the open flower? Mm. So I'm thinking about that, and I just say, okay, well, what am I going to describe? I'm going to describe the usual bowl of fruit. Yes. And then I go on from there.
I adore that, starting with the idea, why not? In theater, we often start with, what if? And it's the same thing, but I really love that, showing you as poet and what thinking goes on before the writing and how the thinking is more the writing than putting your pen to paper. So your process, I don't think, is unusual, but you're very able to tell us about it. You're very able to talk about what you think.
Well, one of the things that surprises me is that while what we're speaking about sounds as though I do a lot of considering beforehand, most of the time I don't have an idea. I sit down and I start with an image or a sound or a challenge to myself. For example, I might say to myself, okay, you have not written a poem in which you begin with a question. Do it. And I won't let myself think too hard about what the question will be. I just do it. And then I allow that to lead to whatever comes next. And I'm hoping that I'm tricking with the game of playing with language. I'm hoping that I'm tricking my deeper self, if that's the correct word, into taking over for my much too controlling, ordinary mind.
Let us have an uncontrolled poem by a controlled poet. I might tell everyone that she is Andrea Hollander Buddy. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on location, but this is The Poet and the Poem.
One of the things I might start with, and I've done this for more than 30 years, is I will take a color and I try to write a poem in which I explore the psychological or emotional essence of that color the way it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And here's the most recent of those color poems. It's called Ochre. I should name something so you'll know just which yellow I mean. The ochre of my bed shirt with the holes in one sleeve. The ochre of the benches at the corner of Boulevard Saint-Louis. Of the curtains in the brushstrokes of Bonnard. His ochre palette. The pallor of the woman's skin in the painting I keep returning to. But it's not just the color I like. It's the sound. The way it hides in the tunnel of the mouth without touching anything. Not the tongue that wants to know if it tastes of syrup or salt. not the teeth that could cut it in two, but only want to trace the shape of it. Not even the soft cheeks that seek to embrace, if only for the slightest moment, the deft word as it enters, braces itself, hovers like a swimmer at the edge of a pool ready for the whistle, then escapes into speech that dissipates before I can trap it. So I say it sometimes, ochre, just to savor the almost of it, the O of my lips in the O of surprise as the ochre passes through. And I spell it the British way, R before E, to give it that hint of unending. So much like love it is, the way I don't even know if it's two syllables or one, the fickle way it simultaneously longs for and turns away. There might be specks of ochre in a lover's eyes, and on his neck the faded color in the mark love left, but always there's the delicious pleasure that occurs as I say its name, the way I speak my lover's, in almost a whisper, as if it were sacred. Say it, and say it, and say it again.
Andrea Buddy has been called a poet in our foremost ranks of American poetry, and I think you're going to attest to that today as you hear her voice. What was it like running a B&B in Mountain View in the Ozarks as you were trying to continue your poetry?
Well, I don't think I ever wrote a single word of poetry the whole 15 years at the B&B. But what we did was, first of all, I loved it. We met lots of wonderful people. We had an eight-room bed and breakfast on the courthouse square of a wonderful little town known for its Irish music that's played on the courthouse square all the time by local people and by visitors, and not a penny of money is charged for any of it. It's a wonderful little secret town, 2 hours from the nearest interstate, so you have to want to be there. But it was a wonderful experience to meet good people and spend a lot of time talking with them. And I cleaned many toilets and made many beds, and that's what we did. But we would be very slow 5 months of the year and very busy 7 months of the year. So those 5 months of the year, we stayed at our house in the woods about 15 minutes drive away. And that's when I did my writing.
What did you cook for breakfast?
Well, luckily, we also had a friend who wanted to open his own bakery. So he had part of the first floor of the bed and breakfast, and it was open to the public, his bakery. And what he did is he made specific specialty breads and coffee cakes and the like for our bed and breakfast guests we served in the lobby, and I just had to make fruit salad and coffee and tea and orange juice, so it wasn't too hard.
This is a poet who really knows what to do, because she's been helping me today set up and find the key and call the right person. And she's a life coach, I think, as well as a poet. And we want to hear more of the thing you're being so acclaimed for, and that is your poetry. And you are you receiving enough acknowledgement in the world?
I think it's quite remarkable. I think that's amazing to me that I could live in a town like Little Mountain View, Arkansas, which is really where I moved away from cities in order to really spend more of my time focused on the writing, and find that I hear from people from very far away whom I've never met who have found poems that matter to them. So that to me is, yes, I'm perfectly happy.
And at this moment, you are probably being heard on a station which is south of San Antonio, Texas. I've just heard from them, and they're carrying the series, so your voice is going farther and further. This is Andrea Buddy. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're going on.
Okay. I'm going to read a poem in which something powerful has happened. Maybe that this has happened to you. It's one of those kinds of things that we think about when they seem like small things, but they turn out to be big things. And I think you'll understand from the title of the poem what I'm talking about. Tiny spider in the bathroom sink. I tried to be careful. It lounged along the left side of the bowl, the smallest I've ever seen, a dot with legs, an asterisk. I turned the water only slightly on and aimed the thin stream directly toward the drain and watched the spider squat on all eight minuscule legs and raise itself again. But after I brushed my teeth the full 2 minutes to appease my dentist and held the foamy brush under the water and flicked the bristles with my thumb to help release the minty suds, I forgot it was there and opened the faucet full force and rinsed my mouth and spat and saw too late the dark speck spiraling down. And I began to understand how it happened that after the doctor announced the bleak diagnosis and looked down at his silent desk, my father said, as if it were someone else whose life and death they were discussing, "Oh, isn't that sad?"
Every poet has a bug poem. I know Ted Kooser's made flat bugs famous. And it is what you say, that nothing is too insignificant. Isn't that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Any little broken green glass in the pavement for William Carlos Williams. What do you have to say in a general philosophical reach about that?
Well, I think it is emblemic of poets altogether that we, well, writers probably altogether, but poets maybe even more significantly in the sense that we are observers with magnifying glasses. We are looking not only at the actual world and the smallest, which of course becomes the largest, but we're trying to look inside our own souls. I know that sounds a little bit preposterous and highfalutin, but I think it's true. We're trying to figure out, what does this all mean? Why are we here? Those are the big questions, but you can't even think in those big terms. You have to look at the littlest in order to understand the largest.
We're talking to Andrea, and we're going to have a final poem.
Okay. The final poem I'm going to read is a love poem for my father, and actually it's as much a love poem for my stepmother as it is for my father, as you'll hear. The poem is called Living Room. In the cave of memory, my father crawls now, his small carbide light fixed to his forehead, his knee pads so worn from the journey they're barely useful, but he adjusts them again and again. Sometimes he arches up, stands, reaches, measures himself against the wayward height of the ceiling, which in this part of the cave is at best uneven. He often hits his head. Other times he suddenly stoops, winces, calls out a name, sometimes the pet name he had for my long-dead mother, or the name he called his own. That's when my stepmother tries to call him back. "Honey man," she says, one hand on his cheek, the other his shoulder, settling him into the one chair he sometimes stays in. There are days she discovers him curled beneath the baby grand, and she's learned to lie down with him. "I am here," she says, her body caved against this man who every day deserts her. "Bats," he says. Or maybe field glasses. Perhaps he's back in France, 1944, she doesn't know. But soon he's up again on his knees, shushing her, checking his headlamp, adjusting his knee pads. And she rises to her own knees, she doesn't know what else to do. The two of them, explorers, one whose thinning pin of light leads them, making their slow way through this room named for the living.
That is the voice, the unforgettable voice of Andrea Hollander Buddy. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem. We're on location at Sotto Voce in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. We'll be right back. This is Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We are on location, and we are with Sarah McClay, who's going to introduce herself with an opening poem.
Verse. You unfold the morning caviar, peel the wrapper from a pat of butter, which I'll smear across croissants. You deliver pearls on a platter. I'll add tiny beads of fish and whirl the string across your teeth. There. Here's a breath of coffee. Here's the crescent of my thumbnail drawn across your tongue. Here's the grainy meat of pear, vanilla, coffee beans, like berries, almost moistening with heat. Fog pads us from the rush of day. The clam's wings slip open. And it's not such a long way from one mouth to another. Nuzzle the morsel inside. Examine the surface of the inner shell. That small orange tongue of lox. Slip it into your mouth. Insert the butter knife between the pages of 1,000 French verbs. Vive, vernir, verser, to live, to varnish, to decant, to pour, fill, deposit, overturn, to shed, to spill. Take this long strand of rain from my mouth into yours, and wear this strange gray weather like a cloak.
That is the voice of Sarah McClay, and who would not want to hear it? This is one of the days I wish we had video to go along with it. That poem was a prose poem, and the flawless phraseology and the imagery. Now we know that a prose poem can have all the lyricism, all the tautness, all the sensuality. Is this not true, Sarah?
Yes, actually, yeah. And one of the things going on in this is a poem in The White Bride, which is my second full length from University of Tampa Press. And almost all of the poems in the book are prose poems. And they operate very much this way. There's a really intense sense of rhythm and really long, long sentences. We'll hear some more.
She's had poems, reviews, and essays in many of America's finest magazines, including Plowshares, Field, Hotel America, The Writer's Chronicle, Solo, Pool, Runes, Cider Press Review. And she's an essayist, a book editor. She also knows film and software. She's a technical person as well as a literal person and a literary figure. So today we're going to see the many sides, the multifaceted sides of Sarah McClay. And we're starting back where we began with poetry. And here's another poem from Sarah. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress on location.
Ocean in White Chair. The music starts inaudibly, as all music starts. She thinks, tonight there is a hammock, there is memory, they are all glassy rocking, undertow, it is mysterious, nothing in the living room looks wet. They can never talk about it later, they are going to be fools, it is the saddest music, they are smart enough to come back. Mm-hmm. It is an act of memory, done not with the mind, but with the body. With two bodies, they are black water under night. They are the sound the seashell makes, the ear it presses to. They are aqua, ultra, seaweed flying through like lace, like stray hair. They pull it back. There is a lie of whispers, but not here. The ocean is the grave of all tears. Tears are a memory of ocean. Elegy isn't even elegy, but something deeper. This is what they touch. It is the only music, but it is not really sad. They do not cry. They do not have to cry. They are the same wave. Later they cannot talk about it, say the wrong things, make promises they cannot keep or promise not to promise. Anything they say flattens into ribbons, curls away. It is this simple. Start by asking her about her day. Start by asking him about his day, and then begin. Listen with your fingers. The sea is dangerous, they say. but not if you're the sea. What they give each other, they will never see in a mirror. They are clothed, it doesn't matter. From the depths of what they're doing, they are pausing, they look up. They did not know the ocean looked like this.
Sarah, you are going to be very famous. You are going to be very famous because you are showing relationships in a way that has never quite been done before in poetry. Do you agree?
Well, that's very flattering, Grace. Thank you. Thank you so much.
That is from the book.
It's from it's also The White Bride.
The White Bride. Yeah. But your first book, Whore, terrific title, very understated. And that is good about her because she has a flamboyance that is so delicate and so understated that it's truly elegant, but it is flamboyant. So very fitting. That won an award, I believe, from Tampa. And she has, I have her vita right here. She has won numerous prizes. She was finalist for so many, Blue Lynx Prize and Kenyon Review Poetry Prize, the Cleveland State University Poetry Prize, Tupelo Press First Book Prize. And she received a Pushcart nomination and appeared at the First Books panelist of the Napa Valley Writers Conference. So you're on your way with three chapbooks, two complete books, and I think the world is sitting up and noticing Sarah McLay, and today we are so proud to offer her voice. Here's another poem.
I actually wasn't going to read this today, but since you talked about the other part, this is a poem that started when I was looking a word up in the dictionary. I was trying to write a business letter, and I couldn't remember if it was whoever or whomever that I should use. Then I got into the WHO section. And maybe this is a good reason to have to use non-online dictionaries, because the word I tripped on was whore. It comes from whore in Old English, hora in Old Norwegian, but the Latin references charity. At the root, it's charis, dear, as in hello, whore, hello, dear, as in loved one, sweetheart, precious, as in rare. Therefore, expensive, dear, cher, chérie, a luxury when given freely, pitting charity against law.
She sounds mischievous, but she's quite a serious player in the world. Give us a day in the life of Sarah McLay. You get up, you brush your teeth. I want to hear what you do all day, because it could be editing, it could be writing an essay, it could be writing a film script. Just get up in the morning and tell us what you do all day.
Well, it depends on the day. Most of what I'm doing these days is teaching. I have 100 students this semester at Loyola Marymount University, and I'm teaching four courses. So, for instance, last week on Wednesday, I taught four courses, and then I came. Then I had some office hours, and then I came home. And I'm helping to run a series downtown in a gallery called Pharmaca now. And I realized that we needed some books for one of my poets that night, so I went out to two bookstores and picked up some books because we were out. And the next day, I had office hours and went to the gallery, and we had this fabulous reading there.
This is L.A., folks. This is not Hedgesville. This is L.A. She's working and teaching and has flown in from the West Coast for this Sotto Voce Poetry Festival. So before we tell you more about her, we're going to have her tell you more about her in her own words, which are poetry words. The White Bride came out by what press?
University of Tampa. And in Shepherdstown, the cicadas are out. So at night, it sounds like the sky is just full of this buzzing sun. It's amazing. Grill. As if through glass, through windows, in a cafe, in the afternoon or early evening, in June or November, month like a fetish of gray, a month of water hanging on to itself until it drizzles, a month of dulled light. He is seen for a moment, accidentally, between appointments, in the middle of errands, walking down steps, the cement steps, say, of an old bank, old enough for granite, for columns, pulling his keys out of his pocket or gripping the small black remote that replaces keys, which you can't hear the sound of behind all this glass, and approaching his car so that for an instant you see his face unguarded, or as unguarded as you will see it, and you try to memorize it, but it's too fleeting, so that now only the back of his head and maybe the veins in his arms that you memorized before, the way his fingers go, his shirt, or the waiter comes. The waiter comes by and asks if you've decided. The waiter comes by and asks if you've made up your mind. But this is the opposite of confession.
Incredible. Grace Cavalieri saying that. The secret of the prose poem I didn't know until this minute. And it is the clause within the clause within the clause. She goes deeper and deeper. I bet there's not any periods in that. Are there many periods?
A lot of dashes.
Dashes.
There are some periods, but a lot of long lines, a lot of dashes, a lot of things going on and on and on.
But how she controls this is through the compression and then the expansion, and that is where the secret is. And being in film, the point of view in that poem is amazing because you have three points of view. But the writer's always in charge of that. So let's hear another and see if I'm right.
The vehicle. In that room of caramel-hued regret, the music room, where they sit on vintage office chairs apart, in that caramel-colored cell of wood and sound, the vast feet between them, the small gulping, glances careful, hurt, and sidelong as a cell phone accidentally switched on. A call gone through, not to an answering voice, but the way she hears him walking, maybe up a hill, gravel, and small swatches here and there of music, like a stain, the plaid sound of a carnival. Just its hue, a glimpse of sound, too furtive to be ambient. This is the look in her eye. This is his hiding. This is her anger. There they sit on rolling chairs, thunder in the room. She daggers in a leather jacket open to her bra, her left's antagonisms teasing in this interim, this scissory elapse of wind, and he objects. Nothing can be fudged. This room, this little length, has always felt as though it's lifted from a ship, a wedge of glamour. Someone's curving walls, the damp silk of its fenestration. Any moment now, champagne tucked snugly in its niche of ice and iron, while the guests in black and white drape casually, as at a gala, through the snaking waves of jazz. And it's the tenor now who pierces them. They find their hands, the fingers rubbing either palm, then climbing up the wrists, the offered wrists, if nothing else. He shatters them. He shakes them down, the singer, with his cry, his plea of hallelujah, as the shirt snaps pop, and now the chairs are rolling closer, and the arms are being squeezed, and there's no room for any truth but lips, and now the clothes and errors drop, and now you know you must be patient. Now the blemishes can faint. The errors can disorganize, the navigation of the wheels can shift, the whole flimsy ditch can fill with water and dissolve, because below his song, the tenor's voice itself is saying, we don't want to look across the room in order to address each other from that distance as Saint Tomb, vacuous and oral. Emptiness can fill, can electrify with touch. Nerves bright as coral, wheels kicked close, twisting on dull wax, mouth on mouth, succulent ellipse.
That is Sarah McClay, and you won't forget that in a hurry. I'm Grace Cavalieri. I did read her in the American Poetry Review in the November issue, and I don't think that was a prose poem.
Actually, it is a prose
poem. I'm going to go back and see.
And that was one in there. Yeah.
You know, it's really hard to get an American Poetry Review. And she was in David Layman's Best American Erotic Poems for 2000 and...
1800 to the present.
1800 to the present? You are among the most erotic poems from 1800 to the present?
Along with Francis Scott Key. And it's not a flag poem.
And I think you're much more erotic than Francis Scott Key. Scribner put that out, and you might be able to get a hold of it if you want to know more about her. Originally from Montana. Well... little did they know, right? That you'd wind up in L.A. with those designer glasses on.
Yeah, I didn't know I'd be in L.A. either.
You do so many things, but what do you think is an essay? You're an essayist. What do you think is an essay?
What is an essay? That's a really good question. For me, like a poem, it's an act of discovery. It just takes a slightly different form, and the focus, when I'm writing an essay about poetry, is on somebody else's poem that I'm trying to spring the lock of.
So that is what you write essays on, poetry?
Yeah, I write reviews, and I've written longer essays. One of them was in the Writer's Chronicle that talked about, it's called The Root of Saying, and it talks about what goes on below the words and how, as poets, since we work with words, how can we get that sense of something in a poem? It revolves around Valerie's wonderful line, if I can remember it right now, "Seeing is forgetting the name of the thing one sees."
Well, you're in good company, because I think Valerie is supposed to be the person who invented the prose poem, and that's all we know about it. But you're certainly in that tradition.
And I think, you know, he was one of the symbolists, along with Baudelaire and Rimbaud, who was really working on that.
Are you doing anything with film at all since you're in L.A., the heart of the beast?
I have. I've acted in some film. I've served in development. I helped somebody work on a screenplay a little bit in the summer. And I've written a lot of readers' reports that sort of look at the film as a whole and try to figure out, you know, all the different things going on in it.
Well, today you are ours, and it's poetry, poetry, poetry. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're in Shepherdstown, which is really a beautiful place to be with the poet and the poem, but we are still, our heart is at the Library of Congress, and it is for that that we offer you Sarah McLay.
Because it's close to the anniversary of 9/11, I want to read one of the only things I was able to write after that event. I couldn't really write for about 3 weeks. And then I went to hear somebody, a friend of mine, do a reading at a museum, the LA County Museum. And I happened to look up at the moon, and this is what I wrote. Prayer to the moon. O moon, hanging in the blank sky like a single ornament, as though you had no weight, curved like a eucalyptus leaf, lucid as a coin. O moon, a reflection that does not blind, giving off your sliver of light as the thin screen of day narrows to a blue line. A curtain sails in the last wind, and darkness falls across the ground exhausted, a shadow quietly drained of human form, seeping into the dirt, into the small fingers of grass, and rising then into the trees, the few small sparrows taking flight as night uncoils its deep agave glove. O moon, honey in the sky, watch over us, even as we pause, suddenly fragile, suddenly kind.
Would you say you are a lyrical symbolist or a symbolist lyricist?
I love both of those, and I love the paradox that you're looking at.
I would say that. I would say it's pretty clear to me. And what is Beyond Baroque?
Oh, Beyond Baroque is a wonderful literary organization in Venice, California, that's been there for more than 30 years now, I think. And fortunately, they were just able to renew a very reasonable lease into, I think it's a, the first 25 years of this century, which is great, so it means that they'll be able to exist for a while more. I went to workshops there once a week for about 3 years, and sometimes now I conduct them, usually in the summer. And they have free workshops, they have readings in three seasons, fall and spring and summer, on Friday and Saturday nights, and sometimes on Sunday. And it's one of the real ongoing hubs in LA that's not associated directly with a school, but you know, it's just it just keeps going.
She received degrees from Oberlin, unless you just thought she was born brilliant, and Vermont College. And since then, she has done many, many things, and she continues to do them. I like that you are a producer as well as a creator, because I truly believe in the idea of a literary citizen. We need people to review books. We cannot just write them and expect other people to review them. So I really like that wholehearted way that you assail the literary life from every angle and say, I will win. You know, I will present, I will produce, I will further other poets, and I will review. I love that. But most of all, I love your work. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Thank you.
Here's Sarah.
A dark colloquy. The words are unimportant. The words do not exist. What is familiar is closer. The turned face, the hair flicked over the ear, is even smaller. The earlobe exposed and the small whir of traffic, birds like whistles. It's dark enough to hear the clock's tick, the fan's motor. Inside, outside's small sounds, the small light of breathing, and the way movement slows. What is breathing, the cup, the body, what is still? And the lips are closer, the breath in them, and the mirrors seem redundant. Light sources widening the room and the gathering dark. The long time we can look at each other and swallow and breathe and not go. And the way we remember this part of the conversation.
Would you say that you write while absorbing the immediate atmosphere that you're in, and as you write, you gather the light that's in the room, or do you collect images ahead of time, and then when you sit down, braid them all together? Because I have such a sense of immediacy with you, as if it is just organically happening as you write it. What is your process?
You know, it's both and more, and it varies depending on the poem. One of the poems in the earlier book came from collecting little snippets of imagery that I was putting into this picture on a table. And I thought they were all beginning fragments of different poems, and then I was looking at them and I realized that they were kind of thrilling all together as one poem. I can read that one if you want, sometimes it is a matter of being in a certain place and having something that I have to look at and continuing. It's like, you know, what Hemingway says about when you're stuck, all you need to do is write one true thing. And often for me, that true thing is something that I'm seeing that hits me in a certain way that ends up having its own rhythm that then helps determine what every other word has to be rhythmically.
The interesting thing I think about your work is that there's also an empirical voice watching the scene, watching the relationship as it's happening, as it's unfolding. Are guys scared to go out with you?
I hope not.
Because you have it like wired. You have the eye that closes. You have the silence between you. I just think relationship is, I would say, one of your mainstays.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, definitely giving you a lot of those poems. I kind of have a deal with myself that I try not to figure out what I'm going to write about until I actually write about the nightcloth. There is always the path back to the place you began, but this time, take another. You have been given the colors of a Vermeer, made in muted light. They are what twilight does to wheat and shadow. And then the man below you in his apartment does a kind of singing, as though he is making song with his fingers as they drum a tabletop. As soon as you name this color gold, it looks like ultramarine, or even distant knapweed, or even a part of the ocean. The dripping rain on the rooftop is now as random as the click of the second hand heard between the shh, shh of passing cars. But really, anyway, there's no where were we. The cars interrupt the darkness with their splashes of sudden, repeated white. There's a kind of rhythmic humming now from below, as though the voice or several voices run again and again into a wall insistent, and the walls themselves are ticking, or is it the heater, or is it the rain? Something apparently wants to chant. We'll use anything to chant. And you, where do you think you're going?
Mm. Love ending that with a question like that. And to show what a filmmaker she really is, she has a multimedia thing going on. She's talking about rain, and we are hearing some on-location sounds of water here in the background. This is Sarah McClay. She is really making a mark. I think she being included in the National Anthology of Pushcart Poems as an honorable mention is significant, because we're talking hundreds and hundreds of poems, thousands of poems that get recommended for that thing. So it's to be anonymously, and not to be married to the editor, but just to be chosen out of the pile, that's really worth mentioning, and I wanted to put that out there. We are in Shepherdstown. This is Sotto Voce. I am Grace Cavalieri, and Sarah's going to read you a final poem.
Feminine, winter, cold. When the blue shadows pull themselves across the hills, and white sinks into twilight, the blue snow of twilight, there is an illusion of beginning. Here, where the field intersects the sky beyond the fence, where the crystals slowly scurry from the firs. It is a foreign house. There is nothing to unpack. It is not yet night, and the day with its covered mouth that refused to talk, that day is gone. It is a blessing. Let it be a blessing. Let the fir branches softly shake their snow, soft as plumes, soft as ostrich feathers.
That is the voice of Sarah McClay. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. This program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Associate producer is Ken Flynn. It is post-produced by Michael Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Witter Binner Foundation for funding the series, and we thank the Library of Congress for making it possible. I'm Grace Cavalieri.